What drives the insatiable curiosity of archaeologists? Why do they spend months, sometimes years, in dangerous and far-off places, painstakingly searching for fragments of ancient history? And what do they really think of Indiana Jones? Author Marilyn Johnson brushes off the dust to reveal the hidden secrets of archaeologists. They're stubborn advocates who fight against destruction by thieves, climate change, and development. And they're in more places than you'd expect. Archaeologists advise the military on how to protect cultural landmarks in war zones, while others train crime scene investigators on how to properly preserve evidence. Marilyn Johnson and Lives in Ruin, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. That's next on Midday after the news. What drives the insatiable curiosity of archaeologists? Why do they spend months, sometimes years, in dangerous and far-off places, painstakingly searching for fragments of ancient history? And what do they really think of Indiana Jones? Author Marilyn Johnson brushes off the dust to reveal the hidden secrets of archaeologists. They're stubborn advocates who fight against destruction by thieves, climate change, and development. And they're in more places than you'd expect. Archaeologists advise the military on how to protect cultural landmarks in war zones, while others train crime scene investigators on how to properly preserve evidence. Marilyn Johnson and Lives in Ruin, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. That's next on Midday after the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Thousands attend the funeral of three Americans who, along with a British national, were killed in an attack on a synagogue today during morning prayers. The assailants, two Palestinians, were killed by police. Moments ago, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke of the tragedy as heard here through an interpreter.
We're in the midst of a terror attack that is concentrated on Jerusalem. Today, in the middle of the morning prayers, while covered in prayer shawls and tefillin, four rabbis were massacred.
The Obama administration is strongly condemning today's attack. While traveling in London, Secretary of State John Kerry demanded that the Palestinian leadership take immediate steps to end incitement of violence. Warning that West Africa is nowhere near out of the woods, President Obama is urging Congress to quickly approve emergency spending for the Ebola response.
This is not a Democratic issue. That is not a Republican issue. This is a basic issue of the health and safety of the American people. And so I hope that Congress is on the case on this issue before they leave.
Obama has met with his Ebola response team a day after a surgeon who became infected while working in his native Sierra Leone died at a Nebraska hospital. Ukraine says five of its soldiers have died in fighting in the past 24 hours. NPR's Corey Flintoff says growing violence in eastern Ukraine is leading to fears of an all-out war.
Ukraine's defense ministry says shelling and mines killed its troops in the eastern provinces claimed by pro-Russian separatists. NATO says Russia has been fueling the violence by sending convoys of soldiers and heavy weapons to reinforce the rebels. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says Russia is also building up its troops along the border. Ukraine fears that the buildup is the prelude to a full-out Russian offensive that will try to expand the rebel-held territory. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Moscow.
The ride service company Uber is in damage control mode after an executive suggested digging up dirt and smearing unfriendly journalists. NPR's Elise Hugh has the latest.
The Uber vice president who made the comments, Emil Michael, is apologizing for his remarks. As BuzzFeed reported Monday, Michael said at a private dinner that he'd like to spend $1 million to hire investigators to look into journalists' personal lives and those of their families. In his apology, Michael said he made the comments out of frustration and that they were, quote, wrong no matter what the circumstance. Uber's communications team, in a separate statement, says the company does not and will not investigate journalists. Elise Hugh, NPR News, Washington.
Dow is up 43 points at 17,691. This is NPR News. Upstate New York is seeing its first major snowfall this season. Heavy lake effect snow is expected to continue east of Lake Ontario throughout the day and into tomorrow morning. NPR's Julia Botero is an hour north of Syracuse in Watertown, New York, where up to 3 feet of snow could fall by tonight.
Residents of northern New York aren't fazed by a few feet of snow, but this November storm has caught many off guard. A local shop, Cheney's Tire, was swamped last night with people eager to put on their winter tires before the storm. A salesperson behind the counter, Bob Cross, said 20 people were at the door yesterday morning waiting for the shop to open. He said he hadn't gotten around to putting on his own snow tires.
Tires are like the last thing you want to buy. You ever notice that? You buy a $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 car, and the price of tires, no matter what it is, breaks your heart.
Snow is supposed to stop Wednesday morning, but bands of lake effect snow are expected that evening and forecast to last until Friday. For NPR News, I'm Julia Botero in Watertown, New York.
U.S. home builders' confidence rebounded this month as both sales expectations and buyer traffic improved. National Association of Home Builders Wells Fargo Index rose to 58 this month. That's up from 54 in October. Inflation has picked up in October due to higher prices that U.S. companies receive for new model cars, pork, beef, pharmaceuticals, and other items. Labor Department says the producer price index increased 0.2% in October. At last check on Wall Street, Dow is up 44 at 17,693. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRowePrice.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
You're listening to Midday with Dan Rodericks here on your NPR news station, WYPR. Programming today is made possible by Bryant University, with more than 150 years of preparing students with the knowledge, skills, and qualities of character for success in a changing world. Information on undergraduate and graduate programs is available on the web at success.bryant.edu. Temperatures in the lower 30s this afternoon, with winds gusting up to 30 miles an hour. Tonight, cold, lows as low as the upper teens tonight. This is WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Rodericks here, thanking you again for joining us. Earlier this year, Forbes magazine identified archaeology and anthropology as the worst college major based on initial unemployment and long-term low earnings. It is incredibly hard to find full-time employment. Many archaeologists make do with temp jobs, working to make sure that construction sites don't unearth ancient objects. But the lack of full-time employment doesn't mean there isn't work to be done. In fact, war, economic development, and climate change are revealing buried history faster than archaeologists can set up a field site. And technological advances, such as satellite imaging and DNA testing, means that more information can be gathered. There are storage rooms filled with artifacts, but there isn't enough money to catalog all of them. Archaeologists have to not only be discoverers, they also have to be advocates for the preservation of the past. We're going to be talking about archaeology in this hour with Marilyn Johnson, our guest in this hour of Midday. She writes about quirky subcultures, and this is one of them. Marilyn Johnson discovered archaeologists in places you wouldn't normally look, too. A U.S. military base on the Canadian border up in New York, a tiny island off the coast of Cyprus, a warehouse in Brooklyn. Archaeologists work with soldiers, crime scene investigators, developers, even beer makers. They spend their days digging in the dirt, but they also know how to court patrons at galas to try to fund their projects. Today, we look at the world of archaeologists with Marilyn Johnson, an author whose most recent book, whose new book is Lives in Ruins. I like this title, Lives in Ruins, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. It's published by HarperCollins. Marilyn Johnson, thank you so much for joining us here on the Midday Show in Baltimore.
Well, my pleasure.
You know, I mentioned that you like quirky subcultures, so I ought to mention to our listeners your earlier books. One is This Book is Overdue, which was about librarians. Okay, maybe not a subculture, but, you know, it's a special profession. But also The Deadbeat, which is a book about obituary writers. And I'm sorry I missed that one because I appreciate a good obituary, well written.
Oh, you would appreciate this then.
Okay, the deadbeat. And then what got you to archaeology, Marilyn?
Well, I think these three professions are actually kind of related.
Okay.
Bear with me. I mean, I really had to talk my editors into it. But but I see them, first of all, these are three things that you do out of love. You do them because you feel a calling. It's not because you're going to be making big money. You don't make the big bucks being an obit writer or a librarian or a... archaeologist, you just don't, and yet you have the satisfaction of connecting people with the past and saving little bits of our cultural history. There's so much that gets trashed, and here you have obituary writers who are saving the biographies of people as they escape the confines of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
You have librarians keeping us connected with the texts of our past, and you have archaeologists who are finding little artifacts and pieces of, you know, ancient cultures and recent ones.
You know, I mentioned at the beginning that Forbes always says archaeology, anthropology, those two together or separately do not make much of a career. We have this idea in mind of the archaeologist as the academic, the professor, such as Indiana Jones, who spends his summers at Machu Picchu, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's
mm-hmm.
that's an exception, isn't it?
Well, those are the people who have those jobs are very, very fortunate. It's not, I don't see archaeology departments really expanding all that much. Mm. And there are an awful lot of talented archaeologists who are, you know, who are working to find funding for their digs, who are under the gun. And most of the work these days comes from contract archaeology. And that's a different, that's practicing a different kind of thing. They're going out ahead of development and basically certifying that we're not going to be disturbing our archaeological heritage.
Right. You know, once or twice a year, we have representatives from a group called Preservation Maryland come on this show, and they list endangered buildings and sites and locations, landscapes in this state, in Maryland, that may, you know, either collapse, be demolished, taken away in some way, or developed into something else. And they're always saying, you know, we care about these things on some level. Some level, everybody says, hey, that's a great building there. We ought to save it. But where's the money? Where's the funding for it? And I have a sense that archaeology generally falls into the same sort of area where interest in public interest. You know, we care about it on some level. On another level, where's the money? Where's the money to preserve this site?
Well, it's not that it's, you know, it's not hard to care. It's hard to commit yourself and commit funds to this.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone understands that. But every once in a while, you take a look at something. These are like fabulous destinations. They really provide a wonderful thing for the tourist industry in a lot of places. And they connect people with their community. So you go to places that are lovely, that, you know, where old buildings have been preserved and where you have a great sense of the history of the community, that place has a different feel than driving down a strip that has Dunkin' Donuts and Starbucks and, you know, the usual.
Marilyn, tell us how you went about this. I mean, I know, but tell our listeners. you sought out to profile a few archaeologists.
Well, you know, my mother just read the book, and she said, I can't believe that you did these things. You know, if people should know that you never went outdoors, you know, voluntarily in your entire childhood. So I just had this idea, and I had this hunger to do it. I don't know why. I knew no archaeologists. I started reading everything that I could, and I would go to every lecture. There are tons of free lectures. Or very low-cost lectures that are happening all over the place. The Archaeological Institute of America sponsors some. Your local colleges and universities sponsor others. And I would go and hang out. I would go to conferences for archaeologists. I subscribed to Archaeology Magazine and Discover and Smithsonian. And, you know, I would read these things that were understandable by a layperson. And when somebody was quoted who was really fascinating, I would send them a note. You know, I write humor books. You know, I don't know anything. Can I interview you? But one of the archaeologists turns out to be a really serious one. I found her in a crazy pseudo-documentary about Indiana Jones and the real Indiana Joneses. And I was, you know, I was interested in the popular culture idea of archaeologists as well as, you know, the archaeologists themselves.
Well, since you mentioned the swagger,
yeah,
they do have a swagger. So I wonder what they thought of Indiana Jones. I mean, what's the point of fighting over or complaining about a fictional character depicted in a movie that brings attention to your profession, your area of interest? But I mean, most of them realize that life is not Indiana Jones, right?
Of course, but he's, you know, they were inspired by him. He's been a superhero recruiter for this field. he's the poster boy. And Harrison Ford himself was on the board of the Archaeological Institute of America. They just adore it. So I would wait. I would not mention Indiana Jones, and I would wait each person that I talked to. How long would it take them to mention it? 20 minutes was the longest.
Well, let's talk about some of these folks. The woman you just mentioned, for instance, who is that?
Mm-hmm. Joan Connelly.
I thought that's who you were talking about. She spent a lot of time in Cyprus. She was kind of an adventurer, wasn't she?
Oh, she's a terrific adventurer. She's like an old-fashioned, you know, and you see her in her fedora, you know, hiking up the cliffs to tackle this site that Cleopatra's administration might have built, and, you know, sifting the dust and, you know, dealing with the weird insects of Cyprus. It's just, she's pretty cool.
Not to mention a venomous snake, right? Remember, Indiana Jones hated snakes, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But, you know, snakes are nothing compared to mosquitoes. Mosquitoes are really the killers. They just don't look great on movies.
Now, was Joan Connelly the closest you came to that sort of real-life Indiana Jones?
Well, you know, I don't know. Maybe she is. She's a member of the Explorers Club, and she really she has an awful lot of personal flair. Mm-hmm. But there was somebody like John Shea, who is a bearded paleoanthropologist, which means he's very interested in ancient people. And he's in particular very interested in triangle-shaped points, as they call them, which were the stone tools of the Ice Age. And he's somebody who gets out there and hurls spears and, you know, builds fires and tries to figure out how Ice Age people might have, you know, might have slept. They wouldn't have slept near the water source. Then they would have been, you know, meals for the wild animals. He knows stuff like this. So, you know, he kind of resembled him in that adventuresome kind of way.
John Shea is a professor at the State University of New York, SUNY Stony Brook, and he has a class, Archaeology of Human Origins. So he's into Neanderthals, right? Or does he instruct you, by the way, on how to pronounce that? I meant to do that before we got on the air.
Mm. Neanderthals.
Neanderthal.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Sorry.
I just can't say Neanderthal anymore. I can't say it.
Marilyn, what did you learn about Neanderthals from John Shea?
Well, you know, they get a bad rep, man. People think that they were primitive cavemen and, you know, ran around with clubs, clubbing their women, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, as John Shea taught me and as I came to learn, just because we know how to use an iPhone 6 does not make us smarter than the people who lived back then. They were survivors, and they were geniuses at what they did.
Did John Shea always want to be an archaeologist? I meant to ask you this about Joan Connolly, too. But
always.
Did everyone you interview say that when they were kids, they used to go to the landfill, or they dug holes, or they were looking for buried treasure?
Yes.
They all say that.
Every one of them. They were, everyone knew what it was they were supposed to be. They were the kids who were out there digging. Well, now, listen, we all dig. We all dig when we're kids. But the kids who kept digging, even when the sock hop started,
right.
Those are the ones who become the archaeologists. Yes, they collect things. They sift things. There's some mystery underneath that they want to get at.
I'm going to ask our listeners that question. When you were a kid, did you want to be an archaeologist? Did you ever have that thought? And have you ever stumbled upon artifacts like arrowheads or old coins? And if you have a question about this field of work, this is a good time to call us here on Midday Live Talk on our show, 410-662-8780. Dan Rodgers here. I'm speaking with Marilyn Johnson, who just spent a lot of time researching archaeologists and their lives. It's called Lives in Ruins, her book, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. I like the subtitle, too. A short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back, Dan Rodgers. I have the pleasure of the company this hour of Marilyn Johnson, who writes books about quirky people, and in this case, very quirky people, but really interesting, some really interesting people. Archaeologists, the subject of this book, Lives in Ruins. So, Marilyn, I'm interested now in Patrick McGovern. Patrick McGovern, who, he's into the studies of ancient ales, ancient drinks, is that right? Ancient libations?
Yes, he calls himself the Indiana Jones of extreme beverages, and extreme beverages being beer, wine, and any combination of those things. Fermented drink. He says it has a terrifically ancient history, and he's interested not just in finding evidence of it, of which he's found quite a bit in places like China and the Middle East. He is also interested in recreating it, reverse engineering, based on the goop
right.
in the bottom of old pots.
Okay, so he's looking for old pottery or something, right?
He was an expert in pottery. Who said, you know, what's this stuff in the bottom? I think I'll, you know, do some chemical tests on it. And the first one that he did was a kind of a beer with mead in it, a honey beer.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought, well, this is, you know, it was coming out of pots that had come from King Midas's tomb in what is now Turkey. And he said, well, you know, I know a lot about beer, and I know some craft brewers, so I'm going to challenge them, and let's see if somebody can come up with this. And in fact, he is the consultant to Dogfish Head Brewery, and they've come up with a number of archaeologically inspired drinks that attempt to recreate an intoxicating beverage from history.
And he's doing it based on the traces of the original liquid that is found in this. Wow. You know, I've heard something about this, about the Dogfish Head doing something like that.
It's really awesome beer. It's not beer. It's basically, I describe it as liquid pound cake. It's really...
liquid pound cake. It's a mouthful, huh?
Yeah, I almost didn't want to swallow. It's really delicious and super fattening.
I was going to say, I bet it's thick with calories.
Yes.
Marilyn,
not light.
I asked for some phone calls here from anybody that might have a question for you or wants to tell us briefly about their own experiences. I just wanted to mention something to you. I remember being with an older gentleman, he's now deceased, who was a professor at Johns Hopkins. His name was Martin Larrabee. We were out hiking on a trail together along a river. And I remember him saying this to me, that for his whole life he had been looking for Indian arrowheads, Native American arrowheads of the Susquehannock, that were around here. And he said, I'll never forget the time when I reached down and I picked up something that I knew in an instant was actually an arrowhead. And, I was always struck by that comment that you knew in an instant that it was the real thing. Mm-hmm. And what a amazing experience that was. I mean, it was maybe the highlight of his life. I don't know what the rest of his life was like, but he talked about it in such a way that made me think, oh, this is like a transformative, transcendent experience to actually touch something that somebody touched 1,200 years ago, or 600 years ago, or 500 years ago.
Well, we spent so much of our time having things explained to us when it comes to archaeological artifacts, and saying, well, this one in particular is older than this, and somebody else is telling you that. When you cross that line and become somebody who knows that that pottery is way old, or that this particular stone point came from this particular tribe, when you become knowledgeable about that, and can detect those subtle differences, it's a thrill. And and I think this is part of what also drives archaeologists.
Mm-hmm. Also, the tactile experience of actually touching something an ancestor touched. I mean, an ancient ancestor.
Oh, that's the most basic thing, I think, is feeling that connection with history.
Let's take a call. Marilyn Johnson is our guest. Lives in Ruins is her book about archaeologists. 410-662-8780 is the number for Midday. Our toll-free long-distance number, 866-661-9309. Let's take a call here, Marilyn. This is Barry in Towson, who wants to tell us about his experience. Hi, Barry.
Hi, Dan. I'm actually an archaeologist.
The real thing,
Towson University.
I salute you,
Barry. What's your last name?
Giplin.
Barry Giplin, a for real archaeologist at TU. Thank you very much for calling.
I just wanted to say to comment on a few things, but I'll just take one thing at a time, if possible. I was enthralled by archaeology as a child. I was given a book on dinosaurs, like all kids, and I grew up for a couple of years knowing everything there was to know as a kid about dinosaurs. And one day when I was about 12 or 13, I was scrounging around in the back of my house in the dirt and came up with a piece of something stone that looked kind of weird. We took it out. This was in Detroit. We took it to Cranbrook Institute to a geologist there, and who identified it as a fossilized fern, millions of years old.
Cool. And you were 13.
Yeah. And
I see where this is going.
So I did not become so engrossed by ferns, but I did become engrossed with Greco-Roman history and archaeology. And when I got to college, I was steered to take a year abroad in Israel and became further engrossed in archaeology, came back, went to the University of Pennsylvania, and became a PhD in archaeology. I've dug in Israel for many, many years. I actually even was part of an expedition here in Baltimore.
Well, what did you do in Baltimore, Barry?
With several other people, we identified and excavated a site at the corner of Fleet and Bond Street that was the home of the earliest building, not a home, used as a Jewish synagogue.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling, Barry, and telling us about your experience and how you got on track. That sound familiar to you, Marilyn?
Well, I wish I'd known you 2 years earlier, Barry. I would really have happily followed you around. But I hear they have some archaeology in Israel.
You say everybody in your book traces their interest in this field back to when they were a kid.
Well, yes, and I really think this was a fascinating to be able to find something that an actual authority told you was so ancient. What that conveys to a 13-year-old? Oh my goodness! I'm a discoverer. I have had my hands on something real. And University of Pennsylvania, of course, is a fantastic place to go for archaeology.
When I was growing up, the house I grew up in was built, along with a few other houses, on the grounds of what used to be a hotel. Now, I didn't know that till my father told me, but we used to go out and turn the ground over every spring for the garden. And all kinds of stuff would come up, broken stuff, you know, pieces of china, broken bottles and things like that. And, you know, people just dumped stuff back. They buried stuff back then. And I think when the hotel was torn down, a whole lot of this stuff went into the ground. But it used to be kind of cool to pull that out and think about it a little bit. And I wish I'd known more about it. I can't say what the name of the hotel was or anything like that. I wish I'd. Now you get me thinking. I should have been more interested in that at the time. But,
well, you know, I did not realize when I started out how much of archaeology is drawn to garbage pits and privies. I mean, these are places where people throw things that, you know, I mean, what archaeologists say or what they said to me was, you know, people write their versions of history and they leave behind in a calculated way in their wills and, you know, passing on to their children things deliberately. What they leave behind that they're not being deliberate about says a tremendous amount about them. Hmm. And so what they throw away tells us as much about their diet as, you know, the menus, the careful menus that they leave behind from their dinner parties.
Hey, before we take our next call, several people called in and want to share some stories with us.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted you to share the story of Kathy, and I'm sorry I didn't get the pronunciation of her name, A-B-B-A-S-S.
Abbas.
Kathy Abbas. Really interesting project that she's worked on offshore, right?
Oh, yes. She's in Newport Harbor, Rhode Island. She is an underwater archaeologist, and she's been working for years establishing an independent archaeology center that is devoted to recording the underwater archaeology and history of Rhode Island. She's written a tremendous amount, she has excavated a tremendous amount, and she has identified a fleet of sunken ships that were sunk deliberately during the Revolutionary War. They were commercial British ships that that the British wanted to block the harbor as the French were steaming into to the Americans' rescue, essentially. She's also found that one of those ships had a previous life as the Endeavor Bark, which was...
It's Captain Cook.
Captain Cook's
right.
original ship.
Wow.
And, you know, it's an incredible amount of history, but she cannot excavate. Well, I mean, you know, excavating a fleet of ships is a big operation, and as soon as any of that she gets her hands on hits the air, it starts disintegrating. So you have to have a way to preserve it. You have to have a place to put it. You get one chance to do it. You have to do it right.
How does Kathy raise money for this project? Because that's an interesting aspect of archaeological projects, the raising of money.
Well, she's got a two-pronged approach, and one is that she talks about it constantly. She publishes little, you know, guides to Revolutionary War hospitals in the area. All these things go out telling you about this place, and people volunteer money. She also conducts classes because she conducts the classes for anybody, and she happily will train people who've just come out of archaeology programs, knowing nothing about ships, or she will train people who say, you know, I've never been underwater in my life, but I'm kind of fascinated. And she's trying to raise awareness and educate people so they get that connection with our past.
Now, does she or anyone else express caution about that? You need to share this information with the public to increase awareness and maybe even find some funding. But on the other hand, you don't want to alert treasure hunters.
It's really a problem constantly. And, you know, and it leads to a certain kind of reserve and even paranoia in archaeologists. You don't say where a site is. You know, if you are discussing things on a listserv, you do not let other people, you don't publish the actual location of it. you know, it's a problem. There are a lot of people who, being told that there is something valuable there, will go and take it. And the problem is that a lot of what's valuable there doesn't have any value at all except the intellectual value that an archaeologist can find.
Right. Marilyn Johnson, our guest, her book is Lives in Ruins, about archaeologists. And let's take another call before our next break. Marilyn, this is Jean-Luc. Jean-Luc, welcome to Midday.
Yes, indeed. Good afternoon, Dan.
Good afternoon.
I hope you could bear with my heavily accented foreign accent.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's beautiful. I like it very much. So go right ahead, Jean-Luc. Take your time.
It's basically a testimony. You know, you don't have to be an Indiana Jones to do archaeology. You don't have to go too far, fetch the land. Here in our backyard, we have some wonderful finds. Our son, who is 16, Luke, is a junior at Poly in Baltimore City. And within his scientifical program, the Ingenuity program, he has to do a research practicum. And he's passionate with history, so he elected to do archaeology, and he found an internship with the Lost Town Project in Anne Arundel County.
That's the Lost the Lost Town Project. Was that Annapolis, Jean-Luc?
Yes, indeed, yeah. Annapolis, and they have digs in Anne Arundel County along the Patuxent River. And he spent his summer there digging and also doing some lab work, classification, learning the ropes of the business, of course. And he found some artifacts and points and ceramics and human bones dating back from 1200, 2000 BC. I mean, it's fantastic, fascinating, you know?
That's great, Jean-Luc. How old is your son now? Is he still at Poly?
He's still at Poly. He's a junior at Poly right now, so he's 16. And he's looking forward to the next time he could go digging. Every time there is a day off at school, I'll drive him there, and he spend the day outside in the mud.
That's
and
great.
He loves it. And it just is fantastic.
That's great. Superb.
You're absolutely right. It's there's archaeology under our feet wherever we are.
Yep.
And there's never nothing there, as one of the archaeologists says.
I like that. Actually, we've had several projects in Baltimore and throughout Maryland and around the Chesapeake Bay. I appreciate Jean-Luc's call, and good luck to his son there. One more call before we take our next break with Marilyn. This is Roger. This is Roger in Baltimore. Hi, Roger.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
I just had a couple of comments. One is, I'm an engineer in this age. I guess you could call me homo habilis because I'm a tool user, and that goes way back, and I'm happy about that. There are two experiences that I had in my younger age, and it really argues for getting kids out with their hands in the dirt. Mm-hmm. The first one was swimming off a beach in what was then Yugoslavia and coming upon, in about 12 feet of water, coming upon the very top of two walls, parallel walls, that obviously had a street between them. This was a whole area that I found out later had subsided in seismic activity, but there was a strange sense of there were people there.
Yeah.
The other experience I had was in a museum, and there was a Lexan plate in front of an exhibit of Egyptian artifacts and temple walls, painted temple walls. And I'm not necessarily a law-abiding citizen. I reached around, and I just put my finger lightly on a little bit of the paint and had this strange sense of connection to another human who lived 3,000 years ago but lived a life just like me. And that odd connection has stayed with me, in that linkage of anything old that I see or a tool. Whose hands used this tool?
Yeah, right. That's the fascination. You feel like you're touching a ghost.
We're talking about people who are kneeling in dirt and paddling around in water and dealing with garbage and things that are in pieces, and yet it is infused with this almost mystical connection for us. I think that unbelievable. it's hard to wrap your mind around it.
fascinating stuff. We're going to take a break. And Marilyn, when we get back, I want to hear a little bit about these contract archaeologists that you mentioned earlier. And there's more to discuss here. If anybody would like to share a story about an interest in archaeology or have a question for Marilyn about her travels and the people she met, 410-662-8780. This is Midday. An email from Alice who says, a friend and I homebrew recreated Celtic Groot. She spells it G-R-U-I-T, pronounced Groot, which is an ale based on the findings of digs in Celtic areas. Based on reports of remnants found in clay pots, we use the herbs like elderberry, bog myrtle, wormwood, and heather.
Yeah, give me some of that heather, man.
They would have used as well, as they did not yet have hops. Interestingly, from a very young age, I wanted to be an archaeologist and began studying it in college, but a lack of funding kept me from pursuing it. Yeah, well, I was going to bring that up with Jean-Luc. I don't know what he tells his son, but if his son continues his interest in it, I mean, what do you say to a teenage boy or girl who's headed to college and is going to study archaeology? What do you say?
All of us can be involved in archaeology. We don't all have to make a living from it. Mm-hmm. I'm perfectly happy going on a dig now and then, going to lectures, going to museums. I mean, it's really enriched my life tremendously. And there are a lot of ex-archaeologists in the medical field, I learned. In particular, it seems like that's when you get burnt out, that's where you go.
Marilyn Johnson is our guest in this hour of Midday on WYPR. Her book is Lives in Ruins, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. Harper's is the publisher. So I wanted to ask about contract archaeologists. These are, pros who are getting paid to do certain things. And I thought the one I might ask you about are both, actually, Bill Sandy and Aaron Coward. Now, let's start with Aaron, because this is a pretty interesting work that Aaron did after the attacks of 9/11.
Aaron is somebody that I picked up at a lecture. I was standing behind her. We were waiting to get our book signed by the famous archaeologist Ian Tattersall. And I heard her say to him, I'm an archaeologist. And so I got him quick to sign, and I went running after her. And I said, I'm writing a book about archaeologists, and I'd love to talk to you further. And she was amenable to that. So we got together for coffee, and she started telling me about some of the work that she did. She's a contract archaeologist, so she'll do a project for a year one place. She'll do 6 months another place. She moves around all the time, and she sort of deliberately chooses jobs in exotic places. She spent time in Hawaii, and she was in Hawaii when 9/11 happened, and she felt removed from it. It upset her terribly, and she wanted to, she felt too far away. So when she came home, which is she's from the Maryland, Washington area, when she came back, she was alert for opportunities to work on some 9/11 project. And she was on a listserv, and they said they needed somebody to help screen some of the dirt from around the Twin Towers. And so she would get a hazmat suit on. She had rubber gloves. She had masks on, and she would stand 8 hours a day. And she did this for, I can't remember, 7 months, 10 months. And she would stand screening on conveyor belts in a warehouse in Brooklyn, some of the dirt from around 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And it's upsetting. I mean, it was like,
I mean, it's grim work, right?
It's grim work. Yeah. And, and it's really, it's like the forensic archaeologists that I worked with. I mean, these are people who are, they're doing some of the dirty work in our society. They're doing something that when you really think about what they're doing, you you could have nightmares yourself. And so you have to be really professional. You have to be really in a professional mode when you're doing it, and you have to have a way to deal with the upsetting human ramifications of what you find.
I mentioned Bill Sandy. Why don't you talk about him for a moment? He did some interesting work up in New York State.
Bill Sandy was the first person that I came across that I said, oh my goodness, there is a story. And I started following him around. He is, he works for any number of contract, cultural resource management firms, they're called. And he's done all kinds of things. But in this particular case, he was assessing a piece of property in Fishkill, New York. For a developer, a team of owner-developers who wanted to build a strip mall on a busy route by a highway. And what he found, because they had, because it was in the old Fishkill Supply Depot, which was not a very famous supply depot in the Revolutionary War, but is mentioned many times in George Washington's correspondence, a secret supply depot where a lot of the wounded from some of the battles of Connecticut and New Jersey and New York would be sent there. There were hospitals there. And he is assessing this land. He's down there and he sees, he has a backhoe carefully removing just the top layer of dirt, and he sees moist rectangles about the size of adult humans. And he said, if you've ever seen the signature of an adult grave, you would recognize it. Mm-hmm. And he found seven of those.
Seven graves.
And subsequent archaeologists using sophisticated equipment found the signatures of hundreds. Mm. He had found the graveyard for the Fishkill Supply Depot, which turns out to be the largest graveyard of Revolutionary War soldiers that we've yet found.
So what happened to the owners of that land and the plans for it?
Nothing.
Nothing.
It's in the exact same place that it was in 2007.
Okay.
The land is for sale. If you have $5 million, I can point you to 10 acres.
But the hope is to preserve it.
Well, the hope from some of us is to preserve it. The hope for Bill Sandy is to preserve it.
Yeah.
And he stayed attached to this land. He no longer is in the employ of the company that sent him out on this project, but he represents the land. And he gets on Route 9 and he gathers groups of people and Boy Scouts and tourists and anybody else who's interested. And he marches them down Route 9, and he shows them where the graveyard is. There are no markers on it, nothing except a no-dumping sign. That's nice, right?
Well, Marilyn, I guess I wonder, if you own that land, you wanted to turn it into a shopping center or a mall.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Could you do that, given the circumstances, given what Bill discovered?
Well, you could not, by law, you could not build on top of those on top of those graves,
right.
But you could build around them, and that's what the developer wants to do.
Oh.
He says he would like to take care of the graveyard, and he'd like to have a Dunkin' Donuts or something on the next to it with theme waitresses or something.
Oh, I see. So Bill Sandy and friends are trying to fight that off.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
They would prefer something that's a little bit more history-minded, I think.
Marilyn, we asked for some phone calls for folks to call in, and they did. So let's take a few more phone calls. Marilyn Johnson, her book, Lives in Ruins. This is Charles in Ellicott City. Charles, thank you for calling Midday.
Good afternoon, Dan.
Hi.
Hey, yeah, I was just going to comment. As a child, I grew up out west in Arizona, and I pick up pieces of Hohokam painted pottery off of our playground. And it sparked a lifelong interest in archaeology. So I've been fortunate to dive on historic sites down on the Yucatan Peninsula. I've visited the Coba down on the Yucatan Peninsula, which is a major archaeological site, and got to go exploring off in the jungle on some unexcavated ruins. This was 22 years ago, and I was down there 2 years ago, and they'd actually excavated some of the sites that we had found. And restored them, and visited sites in New Zealand, Australia, and also in northern Scotland.
So you make this as part of your vacation plans?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I'm passing it on to my children. My wife and I also chase eclipses, so whenever we go someplace, there's always a there's also a large cultural aspect of that for the history.
I want to be in your family.
Yeah, it sounds good, Charles. Thank you very much for that story. John in Baltimore, you're up next. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you, Dan. How are you all today?
Good.
I have I live in Baltimore City, and I have a house built in 1860. And doing some work in the yard one day, I discovered that I have, I'm not sure if you'd call it a cistern or a dry well. It's a hole 9 feet deep and 7 feet wide and brick-lined. And it was all overgrown and covered up. I have kept it so no one can fall in. But I think I have an archaeological site in my backyard. And I don't know how to get into the archaeological loop.
Go ahead, Marilyn. I was going to make one too, but go right ahead, Marilyn.
Okay, I would definitely get in touch with a local archaeology department and let them know about that. And if you're interested in registering the site with the State Historic Preservation Office, that is something that we encourage everybody who has private land to do. If you'd be willing to have students come and look at it, it would be a tremendous act of discovery for you and your family and a possible annoyance. So you have to think about that. But how exciting.
It potentially exciting. It could be also something pretty mundane, too, like, as he says, a cistern that was covered over. I'm curious what that would be, though. 9 feet. What do you say? 9 feet by 7 feet. I'm curious. You could always turn it into a wine cellar, maybe, or something. But you know, you're right. And John, you could call Towson University. We just heard from one of their archaeologists there. So, Mr. Gilwood. Here's an email from Linda. Now, Linda writes to us occasionally with an email, and she grew up in the south of England. She said, "My father, a pharmacist and an avid gardener, grew lots of veggies. One day he found more than one flint in the south of England, so he kept searching. He found so many that day that he was on the front of the local newspaper as the discoverer of a flint napping yard." And we looked up what that means. Flint napping is the process of shaping them into whatever you need, a fire starter or some other tool. So her dad made the front page with his discovery. Thank you for that email, Linda. And there was somebody else I wanted to ask Marilyn about before she gets away from us today. It was another one of these. The subject of climate change and coastal flooding and sea level rise. I'm sure you've heard this from the archaeologists you talk to, that it has increased the sense of urgency about discovering things, excavating sites, and maybe doing some preserving.
Well, and it's presented an incredible problems too, because as the permafrost is melting, it's throwing up organic remains as well as usually what you find, the archaeological artifacts that you find are things made out of stone, things made out of pottery, and things made out of bone. And it's not that often that you find organic remains, but there are organic remains now that are being found quite frequently, as things melt, and you have only so much time to figure out, you know, what's in the contents of the stomach of the hunter-gatherer that you've just discovered, ibex, possibly. So it's really, yes, I think there's a tremendous sense of urgency, and I think another thing that is driving that urgency is armed conflict and war. And we've seen cases recently where some cultural objects and destinations and ruins have been deliberately destroyed in order to mess with people's cultural identity.
Well, there's a lot more in Marilyn's book that we didn't get to, and I certainly appreciate the conversation with you about it. And I'll tell folks again, this would be a good book for somebody who's interested in archaeology or has a son or daughter who interested in that, even as a hobby. Lives in Ruins, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. We've been speaking with Marilyn Johnson, the author of that book. She's also the author of This Book Is Overdue, about librarians, and The Deadbeat, which is a book about obituary writers, obituaries. Marilyn, thank you very much. Nice to have you on the show.
Dan.
Yep, thank
My
you.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you.
See you around. And see
Thanks.
You around, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to Midday today, and thank you to Bagby Pizza Company for providing lunch for our guests located in the historic Bagby Building, where they've done some excavations and found ancient pizza. Bagby Pizza Company offers brick oven, thin crust pizza, sandwiches, pastas, salads, and more, open daily and with delivery 5 to 9 p.m.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richman, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at wypr.org.